Hello, and welcome to our first What's Next podcast, proudly brought to you by Q5 and Prospect Magazine. I'm Jill Weeks. This podcast is the audio version of a live event Q5 hosted in Prospect Magazine's auditorium, facilitated by Editor-in-Chief Alan Rusbridger on a topic of how can businesses respond to record high levels of anxiety? For the conversation, Alan was joined by three guests, Steve Rowe, Mary Homer, and Paul Farmer CBE. Steve Rowe is a titan in the retail industry and a globally renowned chief executive. He was the CEO of Marks & Spencer's between 2016 and 2022 and spent 40 years of his career at the retailer. Steve stewarded M&S through the pandemic and significantly drove the growth and profitability of the organisation during his tenure. Mary Homer is one of the world's leading retail chief executives. She is currently the CEO of The White Company and formerly the MD of Topshop, where she spent 11 years. Under her leadership, Topshop operated 620 shops and franchises in more than 40 countries. Some of her current priorities for The White Company focus on sustainability, employee well-being, and improving the organisation's IT and infrastructure. Paul Farmer is one of Britain's foremost charity CEOs. He is currently the CEO of Mind and soon to become the CEO of Age UK. Paul co-authored Thriving at Work for the UK Prime Minister, a review of mental health and employers. He is widely regarded as the foremost business expert on the topic of mental health in the workplace. Over to Alan and the panel.
We're going to talk about a really important issue, which is about anxiety and the increased anxiety that I think we probably all experience in our lives, in our families, and with our friends, and in our businesses. And obviously, this has gone up exponentially since COVID. So, without further ado, Steve, do you want to kick the ball off with just telling us about how you experienced this at M&S?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Adam, very much. So I'm Steve Rowe. I have just finished as the CEO of Marks & Spencer after, I think, 35 years, misquoted as 40 in some places. people forget I dodged out to the Burton Group, as it was, for 4 years. And other than a brief moment as a paperboy, I have spent pretty much all my life in one form of retail or another. And I'm actually, the interesting fact is that I'm outside the original family of Marks & Spencer, my dad and myself are the only two people to have served on the board in the same role, which was the director of foods. And that's very unusual. And my family has 70 consecutive years service in Marks & Spencer. My nan was in MS as well. And I've calculated that if my daughter, who's 15, starts at the end of my contracted year, we can carry on that dynasty. she grunted at me. M&S has a great history, and you can trace it all the way back in terms of its people policies and the inclusion of people. And really, the first HR departments in the UK came out of places like Marks & Spencer in the 1930s. Flora Solomons famously set up our personnel department, which was all about getting the balance right between colleagues and making sure that their lives were improved, their lot was improved. And that's where we started with holidays and healthcare and things like that. And we have always, I think, done a very good job of doing the right thing by colleagues, getting the balance right, and making sure that we understand how we can improve everybody's lifestyle collectively. Now, why is that important? Because it is really in our behaviours. Doing the right thing is one of the current behaviours, and Q5 helped us really nut that one out. It's something that's very different in Marks & Spencer, and we talk about people as central to what we do. What we've seen, though, is a change over my time, 20, 30 years, in that when I started, the biggest complaint for sickness was S&D, sickness and diarrhoea, for those of you in the retail front. And on the basis that retailers employ about 10% of the entire population, this was the number one reason for sickness. That changed somewhere around 2012. And in M&S, we started to see some fairly senior people talk openly about how difficult it was becoming. Things like email, weekend working, just constant, no stop. And I went back and looked after, and I talked about some of the work we did in the food group. I was running the food group. So we put two leadership teams together to go and look at mental health and well-being in the food division. And they went away for 6 weeks to work with other people, and PwC and Deloitte were leading the way in that field, and came back, and we implemented a series of policies which started with basic principles: no emails at the weekend. Because it's not about you sending it, it's about when I get it, I have to respond. We don't do phone calls unless it's vital. And I do mean vital. We're in people's private time, and we respect each other's space. Those are the very early things. But what we saw is that as we started to talk about it, more people in the organisation came forward. And what we've seen over a 10-year basis is S&D is no longer the number one reason for sickness, for absence. Actually, stress is the number one reason. Stress has grown as a reason by more than 43% in the last 5 years alone. Good or bad? I say good. And the reason it's good is the most difficult thing that we had to overcome was talking about it. And the fact that people can declare, I'm really not feeling good, is important. Now, of course, you have to try and bring that number down by managed process, but you have to get these issues on the table first and not hide behind sickness and diarrhea. And so we started this work in 2012. 2014, we actually signed with Mind. We were one of the founder signatures of Mind, with Mind on the Live Well, Work Well campaign. 2017, we got right behind this work. If you haven't read it, right, I went back and read it at the weekend. This is Thriving at Work. This is the work that Paul did. Right, it's 89 pages. You don't need to read 89. There's 11 at the front. You can summarise. But that is one of the foundational pieces of work in the things that we believe in. And we modernised regularly in Marks & Spencer, and we've modernised it through talking to colleagues. We talk a lot about how they feel and getting the balance right between shareholders, colleagues, customers and the community. And we do believe that's important. And these things change. And, you know, if you go back to the early days of Flora Solomon Simon Marks, it was about you couldn't afford haircuts. Couldn't eat with bread and meals. My dear old Nan overpronounced her H's till the day she died. And he might have worked out a bit of a South Londoner. Right? She didn't naturally pronounce an H properly. She had elocution lessons. That's what we believed. Now what we see is people are very different. The number one concern is health. And everybody's scared of cancer. Everybody's worried about their finances, and more so today than ever before. People are scared of the heating bill that's coming. Colleagues are worried about their families, their children. What's the lot for their children? In places like Middlesbrough and Sunderland, 40% of the colleagues, people who are under 24 are unemployed, despite the fact we have a labour shortage in the UK. Drug use is on the increase. People are very worried, in retail particularly, about their own job security. High streets disappearing. Manufacturers gone. And what will happen? And this is all now pushed on even further by social media. I grew up in age, we talked about this last week. I think sticks and stones will break your bones and names will never hurt you. I think was the mantra. I do find it very difficult when my kids are upset. Or 15-year-old daughter who's every now and again sulking because of something on TikTok. Really? Throw the phone away. But it's real, and it's affecting our people. And then, of course, you know, the response to the war in Ukraine. We have colleagues that are impacted by it. 2,000 colleagues in Russia. We've got 500 colleagues in Ukraine. And our own people worried about the war. And all of these things are just crescendoing at the moment. And so we just put together lots of programs. We've got everything from call lines to buddy programs, to health lines, to extra cancer checks, to financial health well-being in place, available to every colleague, and talked about freely. And that's what we have to continue to do.
Thank you. That's a brilliant way of teeing us up. Mary, do you want to take that on?
Yes, so, I've probably done as many years in retail, so I'm very retail through and through from my 5 years at White Company, and then I did, dare I say it, 30 years at Topshop. So I've been to Burton Group as well. I think most people in their lives have done the Burton Group, I think, if you're in retail. So, you know, huge sort of understanding of retail and that side of the world. And I agree with Steve, you know, it's I think anxiety and stress and everything has always been there. And it was just such a taboo subject that you weren't allowed to talk to it. I think girls probably did a little bit more. We'll sit and talk with our, you know, girlfriends and everything else, but it, particularly in the workplace, you know, it just was not allowed as such. You know, you did your work and, you know, you anything else you took home with you as such. So I think the good news is it has hugely changed. Whether it hasn't gone far enough, and some businesses, I'm sure, and different environments are better than others, but at least it's going in the right direction, which is, you know, I've seen happen. And as I say, some businesses are probably further ahead than others. But, I mean, I must admit, when the pandemic hit, I mean, it was, A, terrifying. And I think the change where suddenly, I mean, I've got only 1,800 employees versus some of the larger organisations, but I think the principles are the same. They were absolutely petrified. I was petrified. I was trying to think, what was going to happen with this business? You know, suddenly you're told, you know, shut the stores, cancel the milk, send your people home, but can you please, you know, keep the business running? But the anxiety that happened then, and I think it actually, as somebody who runs a business, gosh, did you have to learn? And did you have to change, maybe even when you thought you were maybe a good leader and you were very caring and all the things that you'd put in your business? It changed it because you had to do everything remotely and you had to understand an anxiety that had never happened to any of us before. So that was sort of an interesting curve as to then, A, what you need to do through that time, because it's immediate. You can't say, oh, I'll think about it, I'll write a plan and I'll come back in, you know, 6 weeks' time. So you were learning on the job. And I think what's now happening is, it's in theory, as far as the pandemic, it's basically settled in that sense. But the aftermath now of what's come out of it, and therefore what you need to do as a business to then think, you know, how can I help and make this better? Because, you know, you've got the sort of post-pandemic, you've got, you know, burnout, because a lot of people did work 24/7, they were stuck behind a screen, they were in one-bedroom flat, whatever the reason. I mean, our business, from the word go, we could open the office, we had the office open for that very reason. And therefore, and also loneliness. And all of those, I think, have just been accelerated. So as a business now, we're sort of then saying, okay, what were the root causes, but what can we do? And I mean, first and foremost is your culture. And you've got to then look at your culture, and that as a business, that I am responsible for the culture of our business and how that is cascaded through. And therefore, you know, you want it to be the best experience. You want to be inclusive, you know, from diversity, inclusion, from being fun, being empowered. And if your culture is strong and where people want to work, that's got to help what the anxiety that's going on, either through what would be a work perspective or through externally, why they're anxious externally. So we spent a lot of time ensuring from our values and our behaviours, and we've rebooted all of those. We've then, you know, we've got first mental health first aiders, we've done D&I training, we try to think of all the things that we can make and give the skills to actually the senior people, but also all the way down, to help make it, you know, a great experience when they're there, and also support, because even if you've got a great experience, you're going to have people who have a bad day, or they, not just a bad day, but have other sort of more major issues. So how can we support them and then put them in the right direction if it's anything, I suppose, more serious? So like with the mental health first aiders, they can do a certain amount, but when they know it's sort of past that, they're not the experts, and there's no, they shouldn't try and be the experts. So then we've got sort of the retail trust, or we would point them to Mind or somewhere where, or maybe, you know, to doctors or whatever. And I think it's those sort of things that we need to do as a business, and that's how, I suppose, We're trying to do that as a white company. I suppose that's the start for now.
And you both set the position up brilliantly. I'm going to turn to Paul. And I mean, I think what we've heard are two leaders who are presumably in the forefront of thinking about these things. How typical are they? And can you frame it more generally in your experience of dealing with lots of companies?
Yeah, well, very well chosen, Alan. Two great examples of organisations who have really grasped the issue. Maybe it's because I'm in reflective mode as I'm about to leave Mind, but maybe it's because I've never had a chance to stop and think. But I was thinking that just listening to Steve and Mary, it feels to me as though there are these kind of three moments over the last 15 years or so. They're quite key. The first year was probably about 10 years ago, as Steve mentioned, where people were just beginning to have a conversation about mental health. It was still very stigmatized. It was an issue that people wouldn't really take seriously. And a very small number of organizations stuck their head above the parapet and said, yep, I'm prepared to take this seriously. I want to look at it because I've heard from my people that this is something that they want to take seriously. But it was a tiny, tiny number. Speed forward to probably 5 years ago, and my co-conspirator, Lord Dennis Stevenson, is in the audience today. We together were asked, slightly unexpectedly, I think it was fair to say, I remember getting a call from Dennis on New Year's Eve asking me if I was doing anything in 2017 apart from running Mind and whether I'd like to co-chair the Thriving at Work review. But what we had by then was enough content from the vanguard to be able to identify those areas where the best bets, if you like, those areas that seem to give us the best ideas about where to go. And you've already heard some of those, good quality leadership, focus on culture, having a mental health plan, supporting your line managers, giving people a proper pathway, and being more transparent about the issue. And then we've got the two-year moment, the COVID moment, where suddenly so many employers had to really think about the mental health of their people that I think we saw a flip. And not only the employers, but leaders had to think about their own mental health. You know, we got used to dogs and toddlers in on the background of leaders' Zoom calls. They became more human. We saw leaders not knowing what the answer was because, let's face it, nobody knew what the answer was. So suddenly their vulnerability was becoming more open. And people, guess what? People quite liked that. People quite liked some of that vulnerability, some of that openness. So I think we've seen a steady curve, but where are we now at this kind of crossroads moment? And I think what we can identify is a decent number of organisations. So the successor to the Time to Change pledge that Steve was talking about is the Mental Health at Work commitment. 2,500 companies employing about 5 million people have signed up to that commitment, and there are other commitments are available. But, you know, broadly speaking, I think we can talk about a good kind of 15 to 20% of organisations that really take this seriously. At the other end, we've probably got a good 15 to 20% of organisations, I'm sure none of you are in this room today, but who are actually still slightly in denial about the reality of the mental health of their people. And there's all kinds of good reasons for that. COVID has put huge pressure on resources, on anything that might be considered to be peripheral. Where's the space for the mental health conversation if you're really worried about the survival of your business? Well, I would argue absolutely that is the space for the mental health conversation. And then you've got the people in the middle. And I think the crossroads, perhaps for today's conversation, is what's going to happen to that group. Because a lot of them have absolutely reached out, sent information to their staff during COVID about how to look after yourself, how to think about your physical activity, encouraging people to be more, to think about their work-life balance. And we're just getting into a whole new world of something that we still don't really understand. Some people are calling it hybrid, but actually this is much bigger than that. This is a different way of thinking about our relationship with work. It's a different way of thinking about how we want to, what we see from our employers. And it's also about how do we sustain, it's about big, serious conversations about how do we sustain productivity and how do we make our organisations effective and at the same time supporting the mental health of our people. Do I see that as a contradiction? Absolutely not. But I know that some people will see that as a challenge. So I think what we've got is lots of progress. The conversation is not a problem anymore. You know, people are talking about it. Some people are saying they're talking about it too much. So are we actually overstate, you know, I love the title today. We're talking about anxiety, record high levels of anxiety. What are we really meaning by that? You know, are we talking about people who are just a bit worried? Or are we talking about generalized anxiety disorder, the clinical condition? And I think part of our second wave of the quiet revolution of mental health is going to be for us to think a bit more about how we educate ourselves more about what's actually happening to us and our people.
That's terrific, Paul. Steve, when we talked the other day, you were talking about your reasons for doing this, and one was because you want to be a good employer, and you talked about that and MS's reputation for that. And you've hinted at the second reason today, which was sort of productivity. I mean, crudely, you're in the business to make money, and if lots of people are off sick, that's not good business. Just sort of give us some, you know, once people started saying, well, okay, actually, it's not S&D, it's stress, so you put a different name on it. What happened to your productivity? Were you able to sort of measure the impact?
What I can tell you is the overall sickness levels in Marks and Spencer are now down on where they were 10 years ago. Sickness rates runs at about 3%. Even during COVID, we never got above 11% when the rest of the industry was at 20%. And I think it's because people feel comfortable to take the time off when they need to, but also the buddy system that we've got. I think you've got something very similar in 400 buddies, and the fact that it's very open and we've got multiple ways to help people means that it's an open, accepted topic. I mean, we use Ruby Wax. We got involved with Ruby Wax, she uses our cafes, what's called Frazzled. And so they're Frazzled charity, the Ruby Wax. And she actually identified she had a mental health issue some 10 years ago. And lots of people just need space to talk. We've got these bloody cafes that don't do anything in the evening. So we use those. And again, all of these things just made it more and more acceptable in the business. Now, what I do know is that absence is lower, turnover of colleagues is lower, you have to say, whilst it's not completely tangible, the balance is right. I mean, this is something, I said balance earlier, right? Shareholders, colleagues, customers, community. This is a perfect example, right? So go back to the beginning. Simon Marks didn't give people haircuts because he wanted to be charitable. Part of it was because we had the best sales assistants in the UK. The reason why now we protect us are active is because we've got the best sales assistants in the UK. And actually, we want our colleagues to be well, to be fit, and to be, you know, enjoy working in the business. So I've had the pleasure of for 40 years. And you see productivity change entirely when you've got that, because people are comfortable in those. We want the best of people at work, and we don't want them to feel uncomfortable in any way. And so we think it's a major part of our inclusivity programme.
Mary, I mean, you've got a lot of young people working for you. I spent 6 years at Oxford in between editing The Guardian, editing Prospect, and a lot of it was down to language. So we were talking a bit about this upstairs. The word resilience is a word that a lot of young people hate because they think it implies that they're snowflakes and that they should just toughen up. How do you, and yet, you know, those of us who were the grown-ups thought, well, okay, we can't say resilience, but we mean resilience, you know, just be a bit toughen up a bit. How do you find a way of talking about that with your younger employees?
Yes, I mean, it's a very interesting thing because, I mean, I was dragged up and you had to be resilient, and it was like, you know, it was like whatever's thrown at you, and it was a very different word, I think, in that sense. So I think, well, the younger generation, if you say the word resilience, that means I've got to work hard, I've got to work 24/7, you know, everything gets thrown at me, and it's you know, if it goes wrong, it's a blame culture. I mean, ours isn't, but, you know, it's that sort of worry around the word resilience. And what we're trying to sort of, and when we talk to the younger ones, or everybody in the business, resilience can be good, and it can be a good word, because it just means, you know, to a certain extent, you've got to have a coping mechanism in life anyway. And it goes back to, is it just, you were saying, Paul, you know, is it just about I'm having a bad day? You know, we were all teenagers. We know what that's like. That's what is normal anxiety versus what is worse, and then becomes, you know, the big divide between that and being, you know, clinically unwell. So I think with the resilience, we're saying, you know, mental agility and, you know, sort of being, you know, sort of entrepreneur about, you know, trying new things, you know, it's the thing about, you know, learn fast, fail fast and move on and don't blame. And I think you've got to build that into your repertoire of sort of, you know, that is what is being resilient. It's not, you know, working 24/7 and being blamed for something you've done, and therefore you've got to, you know, just get over it, therefore that you're being resilient. I think it's very different. So I think that's what we're trying to do within the business, is say, you know, resilience is good, and, you know, you learn new things, you fail at things, you know, things can change at the last minute, doesn't matter, you know, you might miss a deadline, but hopefully you don't, but if things don't work, then as long as it doesn't happen too often, then I think that's the difference, where they're not, a lot of the younger ones haven't got that yet, but you've got to show them how to do it, you've got to help build that, because life isn't straightforward, you know, it's not, you know, things are going to go wrong, you know, I'm not about to swear them, but you can't. You know, it's not going to be perfect life. And the world at work isn't going to be perfect. But it doesn't have to be negative. And that's the fine line.
The other thing to build on this, right, well, things have changed since we were kids. Right? I mean, there were no phones, right? It was steam paper. There was four channels. I think there were actually three channels when I was a kid on TV. And TV turned off at sort of like sensible time. There was no concern about the environment unless you're in the close circles of Prince Charles, frankly. I mean, everybody in the UK is now worried about global warming. Yeah. And the kids aren't really worried about it. And these are added pressures that just mount up and mount up. And there's a load of stuff in there.
And social media has got, I mean, amazing technology. I mean, I don't dispute it's got amazing things and what technology has done to social media and how brilliant it is. But it's also quite evil. And I think that's not helping the younger generation or even the older generation. You know, it's got an awful lot to answer for that is sort of banging the drum. And therefore, there is potentially a little bit of people being more anxious than they need to be. Because in a way, that means they should be anxious rather than not. And I think that's where the social media is sort of, you know, winding up society. And it's a really, you know, it's a fine line.
Paul, can I play back to you something Mary said, which I thought was really interesting? You said you have your mental health
first aiders,
but they recognise their own limits and sometimes they're not qualified. So at that point, you hand on. Again, playing back my own Oxford experience, we did our best with the students and we had, you know, the best care within college, but there were situations that were just beyond our expertise. But often there was then an uncomfortable realisation that, you know this better than anybody, that the NHS was simply not there, and you had no one to hand them over to. And then you're landed with this, frankly, frightening responsibility. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about that, Paul, and the sort of the limits of what the company's responsibility is in situations where it is actually beyond their ability to help.
Yeah, I mean, when we wrote Thriving, to just kind of build, to try to create a picture here. So when we wrote Thriving at Work, you know, one of the reasons why we called it Thriving at Work was because we thought we wanted to think about how you help and support all employees, regardless of whether they had a mental health problem or not. You know, we didn't call it how to be sicker, you know, or more mentally ill or whatever at work. And that's because what we heard mainly from, you know, people like Steve and colleagues was actually, if you only focus on the sickness question, that's not the answer. The answer here is to think about how you change the culture, how you have the conversation. So we came up with this kind of triangle, and you could broadly, and this is a kind of, you know, it's a bit rough and ready, but so please, it's unscientific. Dennis, help me. basically to think that at any point in our lives, we are either thriving, probably most of us are feeling moderately thriving today, hopefully. And to be thriving, you do have to build, you have to work on your thriving capability, which is, if you like, another word for Mary's resilience. You know, how do you make sure you really look after your mental health? You've got people who are struggling, And I think what we are seeing at the moment are huge numbers of people who are struggling. And they're struggling for all kinds of different reasons. And I'll come to young people in a minute, but they are definitely struggling, you know, amongst the other groups of people who are struggling. Some of it, for all kinds of different reasons, won't go into the detail of that now. And then you've got the group of people who are unwell. And in any, at any point in an employer's space, the actual number of people who are unwell is going to be pretty small. Even though it's gone up, and interesting to Steve's point, actually one of the things we see a lot with employers is as soon as you start talking about mental health, your mental health sickness absence goes up, not down, initially, because, of course, it's the other things. It's the excuse, the S&D. I love the S&D. I mean, I don't love S&D, but clearly. So then I think what employers have discovered is a problem, and that's the problem that you're articulating. So the problem is our mental health services are nowhere near capable of being able to meet the real demand, because they've basically been modelled on some pretty dodgy modelling over a very long period of time. So the maths just don't add up. You know, the 25% of people have a mental health problem at any one time, but the NHS budget for mental health is 12% of the total. So, you know, even at that basic level, it's way off. And although there has been progress, and we've done a lot to shift that on, particularly in a COVID context and particularly with young people now, that additional investment is not keeping track with the additional need. So we've got a problem. We have got a problem here. So what's happened? In reality, many, many employers have stepped in and filled the gap. So, and we saw this in some of the work we do with some companies even 5-6 years ago, who were basically saying we're going to create additional support. And the kind of primary vehicle for this is the Employee Assistance Programme. Hands up anybody, hands up people in your organisation who got EAPs of some description. About half-ish, yeah, okay. That's probably about right. I mean, huge, massive, and that is taking an enormous burden away from the NHS. And employers are paying for that right now. And is that the right thing? I mean, I think that's a really important question that we need to open up. Is that right that employers who can afford it can give it to their staff and employers can't have to wait, people are going to have to wait long periods? I think it offers some real dilemmas for employers. But the one thing we're hearing now, and, you know, the counselling profession is a beautiful artisanal industry, mainly made up of lots and lots and lots of individual counsellors and therapists. There may well be some in the room today. But what we're hearing now consistently, and there used to be a lot of capacity in the counselling system, what we're hearing now consistently is that EAPs are struggling to recruit counsellors. So we're about to hit another kind of ceiling point in terms of the overall capacity. And so this, I mean, if you're trying to get me to come up with a solution for this...
Why not?
I'll lead the witness.
You're team mob happy.
Yeah. The big problem here is that we don't have a proper prevention programme for mental health. So if you're at school, the chances of you getting any education about mental health if you're over, like, 30 is probably zero. If you're at school now, it's probably about maybe a third of schools... ish. And if you're in the workplace, it's equally random. So there's no cohesive model here that means that people are getting the kind of that prevention messages right. The business case is being made by people like Steve and Mary because you're seeing the impact of the intervention. But I don't quite think that conversation is quite out enough in the open. So there's less, and CCLA have done some really interesting work with big companies about their reporting. I think we kind of need to encourage businesses to be more open about what they're doing so that people can see the business case. And government, you know, in this time of straitened government public spending, there has to be a conversation between business and government about who's doing what here, and do you incentivise businesses to do this better, or do you recognise actually what you need is to vastly invest in the mental health system to enable people to get the help and support they need at the time that they need it. The current numbers of young people experiencing mental health problems over the last 3 years has changed from 1 in 9 young people to 1 in 6 in a 3-year period. That's why you in Oxford are experiencing it. That's why you're experiencing it now, because that is a real thing. That is diagnosable mental health problems amongst young people.
Claire, have we, with your miracle technology, have we got questions coming in?
So the conversation is about record levels of anxiety, and one of the more nascent but rapidly accelerating sources of anxiety is climate anxiety, and Steve, you picked on that. What responsibility do you believe corporates such as yourselves have to address climate anxiety in the communities of your operation? The focus so far has been on your own workforce, but you obviously have a reputable brand, big influence in communities. So what role do you believe you should be taking to address climate anxiety?
Look, M&S, we're going to go back to the 60s, we ran programs about energy usage. Right, so we're way in advance of this. And Plan A was launched in 2007. I'm one of the five or six people that launched that, which was based around the fact that we can't carry on. And we all now see that, and at the time we couldn't. It's very interesting. We've done 187 major programs under Plan A, and if I ask most customers, they can't name one of them. One turtle with a carrier bag on his head in a David Attenborough program did more for public awareness of the challenges. And then actually, this week, you know? I mean, when I was a kid, 1976's weather forecast had yellow sunny things and 32 degrees or 36 degrees. Now it looks like the world's about to end when you turn the channel. We have to fix this, but we can't fix this alone. And I think that's one thing I've learned, whether it be mental well-being, whether it be about the environment, whether it be about levelling up, whatever, you need to work collaboratively. And I think that's one of the things that mine did. Is it brought together a number of people, and we share. Even now in retail, a number of us have put in a new scheme we've launched, which is about well-being in retail, mental well-being in retail. And we've collaborated with Next and John Lewis and others to join our forces together. Now, so we all have a responsibility, but we also have to talk about it. And again, talk about it, science-based targets, and doing something.
The other question is more about the support networks that exist for senior leaders, and I think particularly when it comes to some of these wicked problems that you're talking about and the anxiety they might be facing, a lot of workforce initiatives are support through the organisation, but executives have a really tough time at the moment navigating all of this. So what support do you believe is or should be in place to support senior leaders in the business?
I saw you know, actually through particularly, you know, the height of COVID, I mean, the big stress was on the senior leaders. I mean, they literally were, and we all were, you know, 12-hour days, 7-day weeks for quite a few months, and it hasn't stopped. And that's the weird thing, and I think talk to probably most of you and say, has the hamster wheel stopped? And it hasn't. And it's like, well, COVID's over as such, but why? But somehow, there's other things, and there's, you know, recession, there's, you know, war in Ukraine. It is relentless. And, you know, I think, you know, businesses are running leanly and everything else, so it's not like you just can throw more staff at it and everything else. So I think the pressure on those people, I don't think, you think about the sort of the rest of the workforce, but I'm also thinking seriously about that very top team who are burnt out as such. And therefore, I suppose it's then the responsibility of myself, my HR director, and how can we support them and understand truly what can we do, you know, and give them the support. And I think, you know, again, I think different businesses, I was really fortunate that I've got 7 board directors who were brilliant and actually all got on. I mean, it glued the team together, and I was so fortunate, and I think that's part of the success of getting through COVID. It's how they work together, how they help each other. You know, depends, you know, who's got the sort of bigger challenges at the moment. And being that supportive, you've got to build that in your senior team. And that will also, A, support them, but it will be the success of the business. And also then, if they're supported, they will then support going down the chain as well. But it's, yeah, that top team. And I think it's most industries, very, very difficult. But coming out the other side.
I can, there's a couple of hands here. So three hands all over the place. So and Joe's got a microphone. Shall we start there and then move clockwise or anti-clockwise or whatever that is? Yes.
Thank you so much for your wisdom so far. It's been really interesting. I have a question in relation to when you look at job descriptions nowadays, you see a lot on, you know, being able to work in a very high stress environment. So that kind of changes the narrative around it, right? So if you're a young person, you're coming into a job, you don't want to be vulnerable and say, actually, I'm really stressed. I can't work in this environment. I feel anxious, because they're like, well, we hired you because we thought you could. So so I'm just interested from your perspectives, how you kind of manage that narrative of resilience, as you were mentioning, Mary, and, you know, allowing the space for people to feel anxious or to feel stressed at times, but also being able to manage it, because that's just the nature of work and life at the end of the day.
I mean, I think you should not put that on your job description. They were. No, they absolutely were. It was, you know, stress, you know, they were using all the wrong words. And I think a lot of companies, hopefully most companies, have changed the wording to being, you know, it's all about, you know, exciting, you know, they'll use sort of exciting challenges, being innovative, being empowered, being all of those sort of things to actually say you want people to be agile, you want them to be reactive. And so I think the wording should have changed on all job descriptions. But then it goes back to when they're in the workplace. If they're in the right job and they love the job, they love the company, that sort of excitement of new things happening, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. And again, if you've got the right culture around it, can actually be very rewarding, and it can give you the buzz. You know, I'm in the industry I'm in because I love the industry and I love what I do. And if you don't, I always say, like to my kids and any of their friends, don't do it, get out. You know, if you're going to work till you're 70 at that age, you know, the age they are. And it's making sure if you're in the right job and it can be seen as fun and exciting, and then to see the results of what you've done, that's the sort of energy you want to develop in your company. And then, yes, it will be stressful and hard work and everything at times, but it does it, you don't.
And that's also why it's really important that you look after your leaders, isn't it? Because a lot of the energy comes from the leadership behaviour. And if your leaders are kind of knackered and burnt out, then you're not. Then that's not giving the right. Yeah. So I remember, I don't know if this is true, but there's a popular story maybe over here. Paul Polman, who many of you will know, is chief exec of Unilever, used to make a point of walking to the staff gym at 11:30 on the Tuesday morning in order for people to see that that's what he was doing. And those kinds of messages, you know, because there's a contradiction in the message, isn't there? Unless you're saying to people, we're saying to people, look, our values and our culture, I mean, we like you, we want you to work hard. And then if you look at the leaders and they're working so hard that they're not at their best, then that's just not going to work. And I think there is I do think this summer is critical for the security of our senior leaders. I mean, and lots of leaders will go, I can't go away. I think this summer of all summers, leaders need to take a break, because, you know, not least because I think it could be quite a tough winter. But if you get stuck in that wheel, it's so difficult. Yeah. And that doesn't play well to the younger staff, because you know, younger staff are looking for inspiration.
Philip Green was very much the same.
Yeah. Oh, we've got a few more hours on that one then.
Another question here. Yeah.
Thank you. This has been great. I just have a really quick question to something you mentioned about shareholders. Mm. So you talked a lot about employees, which is a huge focus for businesses. Are you seeing much interest from shareholders asking about states of anxiety or mental health, both within staff but also kind of impact of companies more broadly?
More yet. And more, but it's not the big thing, right? Again, we M&S had people at the Wellcome Trust, as fairly large investors in us, and they're very, very good at this sort of thing, whether it be the Plan A ESG initiatives, but also colleagues. And we think colleagues are part of an ESG conversation, right? If you can't get your own workforce, what's the point of talking about your supply-based workforce in the right place? So they tend to have sort of now talked about carbon and your human rights policies, and we've nudged on to biodiversity. And I heard somebody say, by 2030, there are four major institutions who won't invest in anyone unless they've got a biodiversity program. And many of the big investors do have their own programs, right? I mean, they are very aware of it too. And in those investment sectors, there are plenty of people who are in that, who just signed up to the high stress, fast paced environment of the city. And probably regret it somewhat, but it isn't the defining thing about me. I mean, at the end of the day, right? Are you a good business or not? Do you have prospects for the future? That's what defines most things in the city. We believe that balance is important in that. And if you haven't got that balance right, you're not in the long term going to be an investable business.
Hello. Thank you for sharing all of this. You talk a lot about taking care of all of your employees, including senior leaders. How are you taking care of yourselves?
Very good question. I haven't found the answer yet. No, yeah, I'll come to you later. I think you're absolutely right, and I think it has to, because you've got to remember that you're equally as vulnerable as everybody else, and you're so busy looking after everyone else that you sometimes forget that if you're not, you know, charged on all cylinders, then that's no use at all. So yes, it is about just making sure that you live by what you're telling your staff to do. You do need to take time out. I think also relating to that is you need to be very human and you need to be very honest. And I always believe being honest and being human with the staff, they can see a vulnerability in you, and that's not a bad thing. And therefore, again, I'm very fortunate with the team below me. I can be, you know, vulnerable with them, and I know they will support me as well, because as a CEO, for example, it's very lonely. You're on your own. You talk to yourself, you know, wander around sort of answering my own questions and doing whatever, or telling myself I'm having a bad day, what should I do about it? And you need a support function and have that, I suppose, relationship at the right level with other people within the business that you can go in to the office and shut the door and have a moment as such, but that your team see you're vulnerable as well. And I think that's not a bad thing, because you're the same as them. You might be doing a different job. Every job in our business to me is equally important, whether you're doing 4 hours a week or whatever, and we all have the same issues at times. My issues are no different to a lot of the others. So they think you live sometimes in an ivory tower and you don't. So that's equally important. So
Do you send emails at the weekends?
I do actually, but I don't only because that's how I manage my time.
Yeah.
But I think the people who know me who's going to know you don't answer them. Or you do just save one for Monday. But what I should do, I'm being honest, I should probably, you hold them and then send them, but I probably forget to send them. So on Monday morning, I go, oh, I sent you that email. I mean, but yes, we don't have it as clear cut as that, but I hope that we just say to people, you know, you don't answer them. It's just how people manage their time. And you don't even have to look at your emails.
Yeah. And Steve, how do you answer that question about how
do
you...
I don't send anyone an email.
But I mean more generally about how you...
The first thing is I'm a big believer in enjoy what you do. If you don't enjoy what you do, you shouldn't do it. And you said that earlier, and I think it's a really... every time we get people starting the business, I say, look, if you're not enjoying this, I promise you, leave.
Mm.
Right? I do that for your own well-being, right? I've had the privilege of enjoying pretty much... Well, actually, four or five I didn't. Every day of my life in a business. It's a rare privilege, and I know that. But it's because I did enjoy it. I didn't change. And you should feel comfortable in moving to make sure that what is almost a third of your life, right? You enjoy. Have a good mattress, by the way. Eat well. Enjoy your job. This is the theory of life.
And a good pillow from the White Company.
And a good pillow from the White Company. Or Marks & Spencer's.
I forgot about that.
So look, the first thing you've got to do, you've got to enjoy what you do. And be honest about it. For God's sake, be honest about where you are. Because if you're not, you just won't recognise it's coming. The second is you have to keep well and fit, right? And that's really important, because you get knackered. I've just finished, right? I feel so much better after 2 weeks off the job. I don't tell anyone, right? Is this, you know, bull? Right. I was knackered. And it creeps up on you. You know, 4 dinners a week, working 12 hours a day. Yeah. And you have to make sure you're well, and you have to make sure that you keep fit, and actually you do give yourself the weekend off sometimes, and you do give yourself a Saturday. Mm-hmm. And then I have things that I do. So for my sins, I'm a Millwall fan, right? And that gets rid of a whole lot of anxiety and aggression. You know you're never going to win anything, so you haven't got to worry about that. And you can shout whatever you like. But I also dive, and I think there are certain things you do that where you could only concentrate on that, and it's the moment, you know. So I'm a 24/7 work person, right? I live by the text on my phone at 5:30 in the morning with the sales figures, except when you dive. Because if you think about work and not about breathing, you're gonna die. And it's beautiful down there. So I dive, other people ski, and I think that there are things like that are really, really good. I spend an awful lot of time with my family at the weekends. I'm a non-dad, non-brother, non-son most of the week. Weekends, I'll try and make it a bit special. And I just think those things are important. You be human. Be a human being.
That's great advice. We've probably got time for, well, look, there's a forest of questions, but we're coming to the close. So let's take these two questions next door to each other, because that'll save time in moving the microphone around. Yeah.
Hello. Thank you for sharing your thoughts today on this topic. I think a lot of onus is put on the individual to manage their mental health, and that shouldn't be overlooked. You know, things like access to doctors, mental health first aiders, education of our own self, of our own mental health. But what about taking an environmental and systemic lens to managing anxiety? So by that, I mean the design of the workplace, yeah. The design of roles, the design of activities, the office, the environment, the workspace. So I'd be keen to know your thoughts on this and how organisations might balance both an individual perspective on mental health as well as the environmental external landscape that also affects us.
I can hear Paul nodding behind me.
Yeah, exactly. Really great question. And, you know, again, one of our recommendations is all about job design, job control, working environment, and those are the points that we've heard already already made. And I think that's, I suppose that's back to my earlier point about why I think this is a really critical time, because we can make a right old mess of some of the things that we've learnt from lockdown, and we could also make the most of what we've learnt from lockdown. And I think things like working environment increasingly is a big challenge. And let's not forget that in retail, frontline staff are there in the front line, they have no choice. And I think a lot of organisations haven't, in a way, that no choice piece is, I mean, it's not easy, but it creates a different set of challenges. The people, those of us who are fortunate enough to often be able to work in a more hybrid way, that's creating a whole load of other challenges. And I think getting that balance right, and I think we're still in huge experimentation phase. We were talking earlier about, you know, how many days are people going to the office? You know, what's that doing to productivity? What's that doing to people's working behaviours, working patterns? Are you losing something by spending more time in the office, or are you gaining something by spending more time in the office? Who are the people who are the most reluctant to come back in? All of that stuff. And I think we are at the moment still on a massive experimental curve, and we haven't yet quite found the right balance yet. So what we've got to try to do is to make sure we learn from it and we really kind of capture people's experiences so that we start to understand what is the impact on people's mental health, and can you get it? Can you actually make the most of this, you know, the worst times that people have experienced, but can we learn something from it that will mean that people benefit from some of that additional flexibility, but don't lose out on the learning, the working, kind of the benefits of the working environment? Yeah, I think that is the really tough call for a lot of leaders in the next 6 to 9 months once they work out what their system is going to look like. And that's going to be a really big challenge. But we'll need people to put, the data is huge. Just one other point on this. There is now a world of apps out there which will measure every single activity that you could possibly want to do. Can I please encourage people to be very careful about this? There is the evidence base around that not a lot of these is very, very limited indeed. And you know, there is a small industry that has been created, so data, yes, but good quality data is the really
dangerous
key thing
half
here.
Truths. Mm. Dangerous half truths. There we come.
Yeah.
Very quickly. Final question.
Yes. Hi. So I'm actually a former employee of The Guardian. I also worked in store at the White Company in Brighton when I was at university. And I'm a current employee of M&S.
I hope you had a good
experience. I've used Mine's
like
platforms many a time.
And did you have a good experience at all three?
I did.
Okay, then for a minute.
So I'm really excited to be here. But it's great to hear that you all kind of believe that there's been a rise in people being honest about mental health at work, and you've seen a decline, as you said, in like S&D excuses. However, in my opinion, many women are still not transparent about their mental health when calling in sick, especially when it comes to periods. Maybe this is more of a kind of issue of women's health and that being a taboo, but yeah, I feel that women do not feel comfortable talking to male colleagues and managers about menstrual issues and how it affects their hormone levels and mental health especially. So yeah, I was just curious to hear what businesses are doing to combat that.
Okay. Mary?
I think, no, you're absolutely right. And I think what that transpires through as you get older is obviously the menopause, which obviously is also now becoming a much more talked about subject. And obviously, being the age I am, I can talk with authority as such in that sense and what it can, you know, how it does affect you. So, I mean, we were only at the start point of it within the company, but it's all those issues. And then particularly when it gets to the menopause, it can be quite damaging for a lot of women and how they operate for a period of time. We've now made it we've got a, they call it a menopause policy, but it's actually starting to talk about, you know, when you need to have time off, when you, that you can talk about that now. And you can say, it might only be for a day or it might be a day that's happened just, you know, quickly for whatever symptoms you've got and things. But it is a topic that you can have that conversation and, if need be, take time off and those. Whereas in the past, you would never. You just had to sort of come into work and hibernate somewhere or do whatever. So I think that's the start. But I think there's more that will and can be done. But at least the conversations are being had. We've written policies about what people can and can't do because you have to be quite prescriptive. Say, do talk about it, do phone up, do say. But I'm sure there'll be more that we need to do and should do. We just haven't quite got there yet. But
can
definitely.
I just build on that? Because I think it's really important. Because the menopause thing is a massive... What I would say, though, is retailers tend to be a little bit further forward than office-based companies on this, largely because 70% of our workforce is female.
Yeah.
And there is a level of understanding of what's going on. And we find that, you know, we are a little bit more ahead than offices. And I would say to you, you know, at that point about how we get the right environment, whose environment? What's right for one person is not necessarily right for another. And there is this whole thing about how we make this collegiate. We had 80,000 people in, at the start of COVID, 50,000 working, 27,000 on furlough. 3,000 of those were in the office. We had 24,000 in stores.
Mm.
When they came back in, they took 48 hours to get over coming back into this dangerous environment. The 50,000 that fed you all volunteered. By the way, not one person was made to work in Marks & Spencer. Volunteered. We sent 3,000 home before the government even worked out it was dangerous. And I think that this is really important. The environment that our colleagues like, so they like different things. And it's about making sure it's appropriate and respectful. And that the things are important, their security, their well-being, we do look after. They, you know, people cut up chickens to feed us, right? There's nothing nice about chicken factories, I promise you. But people do it, and they enjoy it.
Thank you for the question. For one ghastly moment, I thought you were going to rank us in order.
Oh, she still might. She still might.
But I want to thank the panel so much. They've been absolutely excellent. So please give them a big round of applause.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you would like more information on how Q5 can help you create a culture in which employees thrive in the workplace, please email info@q5partners.com. And please do look out for our other podcasts, which are available on the Q5 website. Thank you and goodbye.